Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us wherever you are consuming this deep dive. Today we're diving into something pretty cool, I think. It's about that feeling, that moment of scientific surprise. You know, like when Einstein figured out gravity bends light, or even the big one, Watson and Crick finding the DNA structure. Mm-hmm. Can you actually, like, measure that feeling?
Yeah, that aha moment, yeah. That intellectual rush when all the messy data, all the conflicting ideas suddenly just snap into focus. It feels almost magical, doesn't it?
Totally. And what's wild is this research suggests, maybe we can put a number on it, using probability, using math, it sort of reframes the history of science. Not just inevitable genius, but maybe more like a series of calculated bets.
Exactly. We're talking about using a Bayesian framework here. Think of it as a mathematical way to track belief. You start with a certain level of expectation, that's your prior probability. Then new evidence comes in and it updates your belief, yeah, giving you a posterior probability. And if that prior probability, your initial bet, was really low, maybe you thought a theory was unlikely, but then the evidence forces it way, way up, that huge jump.
Yeah.
That's what gets labeled Bayesian surprise. It's like a mathematical signature of a discovery.
Huh. So it's not just were they right, it's how surprising was it that they were right, given where they started?
Interesting. So for today's deep dive, we're celebrating the work of Henry Small from SciTech Strategies, Inc. He's really pushed this idea forward using this quantitative lens to look back at, well, the ultimate scientific race, figuring out DNA in the 1950s.
Right, and the core problem he's tackling is fundamental. How does science actually work when it comes to confirming or rejecting theories? Especially when you've got competing ideas. We know theories connect to data, but mm-hmm. how do we, you know, rationally track which theory is winning as the evidence piles up?
And the early 50s, wow, what a pressure cooker for that. What? You had the giant Linus Pauling already a Nobel laureate.
And then these two kind of unknown guys, Watson and Crick, throwing their hats in the ring, all proposing different models for DNA.
It's the perfect test case. And that's why the Bayesian approach is so neat here. It's inherently comparative. You're always weighing your main theory against the alternatives. Does the new evidence make this idea look better than that one?
So it's not just about being right in isolation. It's about being the best bet on the table at that moment.
Precisely. And the specific tool used in the study is called the Naive Bayes model. Now, naive here doesn't mean simple-minded. It just has a specific mathematical assumption.
Okay, what's that?
It assumes the different pieces of evidence are independent. So, for example, figuring out the hydrogen bonding correctly doesn't automatically guarantee you'll satisfy, say, Chargaff's rules about base pairing. You have to treat each piece of evidence, X-ray data, chemical rules, water content, as separate updates to your confidence.
That makes sense. But here's a big question. How do you get the numbers? We can't exactly hop in a time machine and ask Watson, hey, Jim, on a scale of 0 to 1, how confident were you feeling right now?
Huh. No, definitely not. That's the tricky part. And where the historical analysis comes in, since we don't have their subjective probabilities, the study digs deep into the historical record. We're talking letters, notebooks, biographies, published papers.
Trying to reconstruct their mindset?
Kind of. Trying to infer how consistent the evidence at the time seemed with the models at the time, based on what they wrote and said, they developed a coding system, a simple 5-point scale.
What did that look like? Not super complex, I hope.
No, intentionally simple to avoid pretending we have more precision than we do, basically. 0.7 if the evidence strongly supported the model, 0.3 if it strongly contradicted it, like a real killer blow, and 0.5 for neutral evidence didn't really help or hurt.
Okay, 0.7 good, 0.3 bad, 0.5 meh.
Pretty much. And they applied these scores to all the relevant pieces of evidence for each model being considered. Then the Bayesian math combines those scores to give an overall probability for the model.
And this links the models together, right? If one model fails badly, that affects the starting point for the next one.
Absolutely. That's the belief updating in action. The posterior probability of the model you just evaluated becomes the prior probability, the starting confidence for the next model you consider. If you just had a disaster, your starting confidence for the next try is going to be low.
Got it. And confirmation. That only happens if the evidence makes the posterior probability higher than the prior you started with. The data has to actually improve the odds.
That's the key. It has to make the theory look better than it did before compared to the alternatives.
All right, so we have this tool now, this 0.3 to 0.7 scale, mapping historical confidence. Let's apply it. Where does the story start? Watson Crick's first try. The infamous one.
Yep, Model 1, their initial triple helix, late 1951. They started fresh, so a neutral prior. 0.5, a 50-50 shot. They were inspired by Pauling's alpha helix for proteins. Thought maybe DNA was similar. Tried to cram three chains together based on early X-ray data.
But it crashed to burn pretty fast, didn't it?
Well, spectacularly. The historical accounts show it clashed hard with basic chemistry. Coded as strongly inconsistent, 0.3 on multiple counts, it massively underestimated how much water should be there, the bond angles were wrong, and the big one. DNA strands are negatively charged. How do you hold three negative strands together? They couldn't figure out how positive ions could stabilize it.
Ouch. So what did the math say?
Big disconfirmation. The probability plummeted from the starting 0.5 all the way down to a posterior 0.24. Watson himself called it a fiasco in his book. That's a huge drop in confidence mathematically captured.
Okay, fiasco number one. Then the competition steps up.
Pauling.
Right. Early 1953, Linus Pauling proposes his own triple helix. Now, Watson and Crick are looking at this model, but their starting point, their prior, is colored by their own failure. So they start from their low posterior of 0.24.
They're already skeptical of triple helices.
Exactly. And Pauling's model had issues too, but Watson immediately spotted a killer flaw, something chemically impossible. Pauling's structure had hydrogen atoms on the phosphate groups. It wasn't acidic.
And DNA is definitely acidic.
Very acidic. Those phosphate groups are always negatively charged in water. They don't hold onto their hydrogens. For Watson, that was another strongly inconsistent piece of evidence, 0.3.
So applying that to Pauling's model, starting from their own low 0.24 confidence.
It dropped even further. The posterior probability calculated from Watson and Crick's viewpoint was just 0.16. Basically, the triple helix idea, whether theirs or Pauling's, looked like a dead end statistically.
Okay, the triple helix is out. What now? Things must have seemed pretty bleak.
Well, this is where a key piece of data changes the game. Rosalind Franklin's photo 51.
Ah, the famous X-ray picture. The black cross.
That's the one. When Watson saw it, it screamed helix, so they pivoted. Model 3. Watson's double helix attempt, but a flawed one initially. They kept the low prior, 0.24, because things hadn't really worked out yet.
But the X-ray data was a big plus.
Huge plus. Strong support for a helix, 0.7. And crucially, Watson started thinking about replication. How could DNA copy itself? He sketched a model where the chains separate and act as templates. This wasn't hard proof. But it offered potential. What scientists call fruitfulness, it got coded as weak support, 0.6.
Okay, so some positives. But I remember this model had massive problems too.
Oh yeah, big ones. It didn't have the right symmetry, C2 symmetry, which other data suggested. It didn't fit the known 34 angstrom repeat distance from the X-rays.
Right.
And it completely violated Chargaff's rules.
The ATGC rule.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty fatal. So lots of 0.3s again.
Several strong inconsistencies, yes. But here's the kicker. Despite all those flaws, the posterior probability calculated for this model increased to 0.32.
Wait, hold on. How? How does a model with fundamental flaws gain probability? From 0.24 up to 0.32, that seems counterintuitive.
It does, but this is maybe the most interesting result. Remember, it's always comparative. This flawed double helix was being compared against the triple helix models they just discarded. And guess what? Many of the flaws, like the symmetry problem or fitting the X-ray data precisely, were also problems for the triple helix.
So it wasn't perfect, but it wasn't necessarily worse on those points than the alternative.
Exactly. And it had one thing the triple helix didn't have, that glimmer of a replication mechanism. That slight advantage, that fruitfulness factor, was just enough to nudge the probability up. It was a small step, only a 33% increase, but it was confirmation. It suggested they were finally, maybe, on a better track, even if it wasn't right yet.
Wow. Okay, so that tiny, almost paradoxical jump from 0.24 to 0.32 was the crucial turning point, statistically speaking. It set the stage.
It absolutely did. It provided the baseline, the prior confidence of 0.32 for the final act. Model 4, Watson and Crick's final double helix, the ATGC pairing model.
And the breakthrough here was figuring out the base pairing correctly, something about tautomers.
Yes. Jerry Donahue, a crystallographer sharing their office space, pointed out that the textbook forms of the bases Watson was using were likely wrong. He suggested the keto forms were dominant. Watson started playing with cardboard cutouts using these correct shapes.
And suddenly
it all fit. A pairs perfectly with TG, pairs perfectly with C. And crucially, the AT pair looks geometrically identical to the GC pair.
Like perfect puzzle pieces.
Exactly. And everything that was wrong before just vanished. Chargaff's rules. Perfectly explained. 0.7. C2 symmetry. Yep, it's there. 0.7. The 34 angstrom repeat. Fit perfectly. Correct hydrogen bonding. Nailed it. 0.7. Bond length. Okay. Yes, 0.7. It was a cascade of confirmation.
So you plug all those 0.7s into the Bayesian calculation, starting from that prior of 0.32.
And the result is dramatic. The final posterior probability skyrockets to 0.97.
Whoa. From 0.32 to 0.97.
That's the Bayesian surprise. A massive, 203% increase in probability? That's the quantitative signature of the discovery. That's Crick bursting into the Eagle Pub saying they'd have found the secret of life. It's the moment uncertainty collapsed.
So this analysis suggests that what we call a discovery really corresponds to that incredibly sharp, evidence-driven spike in probability.
It seems to map onto that feeling very well. And what's also interesting is that it wasn't just the hard data, like x-rays. The analysis shows softer factors mattered, too.
Soft factors? Like what?
Well, like the analogy to Pauling's alpha helix early on. It wasn't strong evidence, but it gave them a starting point. It influenced their priors, you could say. And that idea of fruitfulness, the potential for the model to explain replication that clearly played a role in boosting the double helix over the triple, even when the double helix was still flawed. These less empirical factors had a quantifiable impact on belief.
And it also highlights how evidence changes meaning, doesn't it? Like Chargaff's rules, they were known, but didn't really matter for the triple helix models.
Precisely. Because in those models, the bases were sort of dangling off the outside. Their pairing wasn't constrained. But as soon as Watson and Crick put the bases on the inside of the double helix,
so the how they paired up became absolutely critical.
Suddenly, Chargaff's rules went from being just some chemistry observation to a make-or-break test for the model. Evidence gains its power from the theory you're testing.
This whole probabilistic view, it feels like a challenge to some older ideas about science, maybe. Like Thomas Kuhn's idea of paradigm shifts being almost irrational conversions because the old and new theories are just too different to compare directly.
It does offer a counter-narrative. This Bayesian analysis suggests that actually you can rationally compare competing theories, even very different ones proposed over time, by carefully tracking how they stack up against the accumulating evidence available at that time. It paints theory change not as a leap of faith, but as a process driven by the weight of evidence, favoring the theory that best explains the data compared to its rivals.
Of course, we have to remember the caveat, right? The numbers themselves, the 0.3s and 0.7s, are based on interpreting historical documents.
Right.
They aren't direct measurements of brainwaves.
Absolutely. It's a reasoned reconstruction based on the historical trail, not mind reading.
Yeah.
But it's a systematic way to try and quantify that historical process.
So wrapping this up, the take-home message seems to be that the discovery of the double helix wasn't some smooth march to victory. It was messy, probabilistically messy.
Definitely. Big failure at first, dropping from 0.5 down to 0.24. Then that weird counterintuitive confirmation bump, 0.24 up to 0.32, despite major flaws, just because it was better than the alternative and hinted at replication.
And that set the stage for the final massive surge to 0.97. when all the pieces finally clicked into place with the correct base pairing.
That's the story the numbers tell. The discovery was the point where one model overwhelmingly minimized the uncertainty by explaining so much disparate evidence simultaneously.
Which leaves us with a really interesting thought, I think. How should we teach these stories? Should we present breakthroughs like DNA as moments of pure, inevitable genius? Or should we maybe talk more about them as this succession of bets of probabilistic reasoning weighing flawed ideas against each other until one finally pulls ahead based on the evidence?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe wherever you are consuming this deep dive and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.